Space Oddity.
Hello and welcome to today's episode of Space Oddity, the podcast of the CSC 1265. Our absence in recent months was due to the intense efforts we made together to finalize the extension proposal and the final presentation of the second funding period for the DFG in July. Back from holiday and back on track, we are now looking forward to what comes next. Today, we will listen to a recording of a panel discussion from 13th March, held as part of Stephanie Bürkle's final exhibition after 3 years of researching the imaginations of Venice, which took place at Projektraum Mindblow on the Pfefferberg in Berlin. The main topic of this discussion was the commodification, capitalization, and digitalization of Venice by platforms such as Airbnb and Google Maps. Taking part in the discussion alongside Stephanie Bürkle, who is a professor of visual arts and the principal investigator of Project UR, Migrating Spaces and Tourism 2, where Ingolstadt Schäfer, professor of sociology of technology and innovation, as well principal investigator of the Project BO4, Locative Media 2, and his postdoctoral researcher, Nicolas Sehner, along the two PhD students, Christina Hecht and Simon Pohl, who are conducting research together in Project CO7, Platform Economy. The discussion was moderated by Dr. Severin Magan, who is the principal investigator of Project CO6, Afronovelas, and head of the Method Lab of the CSC. You will also find the links to the subproject and the discussed maps in the show notes. Last but not least, if you are visiting the Biennale in Venice this September and you missed the exhibition by Stephanie Bürkle in Berlin, go to the Palazzetto Tito and join the Vernissage on 4th September at 6 p.m. or drop in another day before September 27th. So, enjoy!
Start right again, because of course we all know the phenomenon of Airbnb and we also know it from Berlin. That's also maybe a linkage from Venice to Berlin. And of course it is absolutely extreme and everybody I think knows about or heard about that there's this over-tourism phenomenon and that it's part of driving people away from Venice, people can't get apartments, etc. Whereas when I started this artistic research project, that was not about it. It was you mentioned the very academic title it has, and then I tried to call it to make people understand what am I doing or what am I researching. I called it then Imaginations of Venice, which meant that there's so many different imaginations and that all the images that Venice produced all over the years and the time, and that started very early in the case of Venice, that they kind of make or force Venice to stay what we all expect from Venice. So that's very short, that's the hypothesis. And then I had also 3 years of time of traveling and interviewing people, and I tried to interview people living in Venice, which we could say these are Venetians, but you also know who in Berlin is a Berliner. This is a bit the phenomenon in Venice too. And it's very difficult to meet real Venetians because there are so few of them now, 30,000 expected and maybe 50,000 French and English and German owners of apartments or of Murano apartments or whatsoever. So, and in all these interviews, we had a range of questions. And then we asked about how do you live in this city, which is so overcrowded? How do you see the situations and so on? And let's say with almost everybody, we had two or three meetings. And at least at the second or the third meeting, it came out that almost everybody had an Airbnb by himself or inherited an apartment and, of course, kept it for the children. And there's a very strong family bind, of course, and that's very Italian within Venice especially because there's so few. So what happens is mainly what happens here in Berlin. People don't give away their apartments. Even if they move to the countryside, they keep the apartments if they're owner or if they only rent, they sublet it. And of course, that lends to Airbnb. And then Airbnb had spread enormously, but was then regulated by the Comune of Venedig, but it was very regulated on a very high level. So everybody has to declare it. And this is, for example, when you see, it's so nice to be in this exhibition, you see the finding is, for example, all these little bell ring plates. And if you look close to them, they're not only picturesque, of course, they're very picturesque, but then you see also these boxes for keys. And you can have them in Berlin everywhere too. So what makes the city does not change on the surface, but of course it's getting hollowed out. And this locazione turistica, you can see it everywhere. And I found that really scary, because especially everybody tries to say, yeah, but there's less touristic and more touristic areas. But it's not true. The Airbnb thing, as you might have also seen, is covering everything. But I also found out it's not so easy to judge. Why would I judge somebody who keeps the apartment of his parents? Because he thinks when his children come back from studying, he wants them to be in Venice, and then he wouldn't find anything for them.
But maybe that's exactly the moment where you would like to, I mean, around all this topic of regulation, what is your, you brought also some quote, and how do you assess what just Stefanie said about Venedig and in comparison to Berlin or to Cape Town?
I think what is really apparent in all of my interviews is that these Airbnb hosts feel like the southern goat somehow for politics that fail to do good politics on the rental market. And they're like, okay, like, we are seen as the problem here, but actually it's so little apartments compared to the whole share of apartments in Berlin. So this is one side. But there it also comes through that I mainly spoke still with individual hosts. So some of them rent a room, some also rent three or four flats. But I did not cover, and I'd be interested if you covered some hosts like these corporate commercial hosts who have like 20 apartments who rent them through Airbnb. And all of my interviewees were like, why don't get these people regulated more strictly? These people renting commercial units via Airbnb, which is not even illegal under the Zweckentfremdungsverbotsgesetz, so the law that's regulating Airbnb in Berlin. And I think the quote of Marianne quite nicely illustrates that, because she's like, okay, when you like do it in a careful, small-scale way, then it could be socially compatible. So like that is an interesting point, I think. But then to connect to you again, so how to judge? Marianne is an artist who finances her family with renting via Airbnb. And I've got quite some interviewees who do it this way, so how to judge them? But on the other hand, I also spoke to like neighborhood initiatives in central areas, which is where lots of Airbnbs concentrate. Maybe Simon can show you a graph in a minute on that, I don't know. And in these areas, they report that really the feeling of the neighborhood changes, which is not only because there's new faces every week and you don't know your neighbor anymore, but it's also the local infrastructure. So this touristification of cafes and stuff like that, and local shops which cater to tourist demand, but you cannot get any like daily utensils you may need.
That's the big chapter. I call it transformation under the image, so the image stays the same. And we saw so many. Venice is an incredible example of transformations, also over the centuries. So lately, for example, you had the biggest post office in the Fondazione Tedesca, and it has been transformed to a luxurious shopping mall by Rem Koolhaas and by a Hong Kong Chinese GmbH. Yeah? But so, of course, nobody needs the shopping mall of the Venetian. They much rather would have kept their post office. But the post office was over-dimensioned too. So this is, and there's, for example, there's an old cinema. Nobody goes there anymore. But we unfortunately have examples very similar to that, and has been transformed to a supermarket. Because that's what is really working. And I met also very old Venetians and said, of course, I'm sad that my butcher is not there. But then also there are new cooperatives coming up with fresh vegetables from islands. And he said, and actually the supermarket is fantastic because for the tourists it's open all night. And now it is like in Santa Monica, I can have a sandwich at any time I like. It's always two-sided, yeah.
Yeah, I guess that's actually quite a good starting point for what I'm going to talk about. Because for us, it's as well about transformations. It's about like who owns the city and who owns the infrastructure, the housing infrastructure of the city. And what we do for our project is to look at Airbnbs based on the listing type. So where we look at are these people like Marianne who try to support their livelihood, try to keep their flat, or do they actually take away from people living in the city and taking housing away from people in the city? And you might see this on the top graph there, like the green line and the blue line. Those are people who can't live in these flats. Because on the top line, these are people who rent multiple apartments. And the blue line, those are flats which are rented out for 120 days, so at least 4 months out of the year. So it's quite infeasible that these people actually live there. So they just take these properties and rent them out to tourists. And the people who actually try to support their livelihood are this red line down below. And we see similar dynamics if we look at the spatial configuration. If you look at these maps on the left side, got like all listings, and you can see like they are focused right in the touristic center of the Old Town Venice. And we've got like some places on the mainland, some places in Lido. And we can see like who targets which area. We can see that the amateurs, they target like all areas where people live, obviously, because they rent the places where they live in. But the professionals, they target the touristic center, and they target the touristic center on the mainland. So like they take away from people who might want to live and who might want to take their life there. And maybe that's taking a bit from later on, but just quickly talking about regulation, because you also brought it up. In Venice, people can rent out like free flats. Like that's no business. Like they don't have a problem there. But if they want more than free flats, they need a special permit. And I also plotted this dynamic. And as you can see, like the people who rent out one flat for 120 days or up to three flats, they're situated again in the areas where people live. So they are actually like residents who do something there. But the actual tourist pressure, like the people who provide the most accommodation within the city, are those who have more than three flats and who need special permits. So even though the city officials in Venice keep saying they don't want over-tourism, you can see they're kind of compliant there because they contribute the vast majority of listings in this area.
Whenever you have time, or maybe a few of you already saw the video upstairs, there's a video which gives some insights also in my interviewees, and then there's a very clear woman. She is actually originally from Jordan, but she grew up in Venice. She does not feel like a Venetian. She also is an Airbnb host. And I think everybody is really involved in it. And the question already, if you have three apartments, you don't need permission. It's already incredible. And the 20, we did not meet anybody like that, what you call the professional. And I think it's also difficult to tell because in nowadays, I think the biggest host in Venice was around 100 apartments. And then I compared in Berlin. You all can do that. There's this wonderful Inside Airbnb website who gathered all the information from Airbnb themselves. In Berlin, there's one thing, they have 250 apartments, but they don't own them. And that's the next step. That's another platform which sits on top of Airbnb platform, which kind of curates the best fitting for they offer them. Do you have an enterprise? You have managers. We look for the nice apartment for them. So they kind of make a selection of what is already existing, and then they offer these apartments. So they don't own it. So you don't really know if somebody really owns 20 apartments. But of course, if you buy a palazzo and you transform it into a hotel or whatsoever, then you have 20 apartments. Regarding Venice, it's also very clear. If you make that, if this is a three apartment thing, you have to prove that the building has yes, it's a latrina actually, but of course it's not in Germany, for example, it has to be étanche, dicht, yeah. In Venice, obviously, it is a so-called Sickergrube, which remains the thick parts and let's go with the thin parts. Which means on the backlash, it's very simple that all the other buildings don't have that. So the canalization still works like for 800 years ago. So if you buy a palazzo and transform it into a hotel, which one of my interviewees told me he had to do as an architect, because some Dubai people bought a palazzo, so he has to integrate something like that in the foundations, which are wooden foundations. And he says, I don't know if this is good for the building, what I do now, but it's the regulation. So it's also technically wise, you know, and even in Berlin, we had water problems the last 3 years. We had them because of tourism. Nobody talked about that. We had Großklinike and we had all the lakes going down Sacroer See, Großkliniker See, which was really dramatic. But when you look at it, you find out that there's 3 Wasserwerke of the Wasserwerke Berlin just right on the border. And they dig into the groundwater, and that makes the groundwater lakes go down.
Just to jump in quickly, I think this is such a paradox, because like with increasing regulation, which is actually aiming at securing like the city for the permanent residents, but it just contributes to more commercial actors entering the platform like for Airbnb. This is such a paradox. And also what you were talking about with the other platform that sits on top of the platform, I also spoke to another host who rents holiday apartments, commercial units. She's doing it for, I don't know, 10 years or so, and is on Airbnb since 2015. And she also complained about more and more large commercial players entering the platform and making it even harder for her, who is very established on Airbnb, to compete, because the demands of the guests just keep on rising and everyone wants this basically hotel-like experience, but maybe a little more cozy, flat feeling. And yeah, she told me, okay, when there's like a 4-star rating, I'm basically fucked.
I don't know if we want to go to the second topic, because I mean, I found it very, in the preparation of this evening, I found it very interesting how you told us that somehow Airbnb is just one actor in this commodification of the city, that there is also like, that's what you discovered or what you somehow picked in the research, is that there is like other very powerful actors.
Yes, it's like when we call about this hollowing out or Aushöhlung, yeah, der Stadt, it is, of course, you know, like artists always look for empty spaces because they're always keen on studios or exhibition locations whatsoever. And especially Berlin artists are. We are used to that. But of course, then in Venice, you realize there's a lot of empty space. It's just quite, one wouldn't expect. There's a lot of rundown areas. There's a lot of empty churches, which Napoleon took down. And not everything is used. Sometimes the biennial itself, of course, has been a huge driver of this engine in the last 25 years, actually. 1999, when my first photography here starts, Harald Seemann made the first biennial, his first biennial, and that was the first time he opened the Arsenale. So whoever went to the Arsenale is the old warship, actually where the warships were constructed and the armory was. So it's a huge military, it's the place in Venice, which is the foundation of its power. And so he transformed that into an art exhibition space, which was gorgeous, but it never ended. So year after year, or after second year, always a new space was opened. And what is not really visible, because it's not a platform yet, it might become a platform soon, there are agencies. If you have a garage, if you have an empty palazzo, if you have something you want to commercialize, you call these agencies. And they look after, they make everything for you, plans, maps, electricity, and they offer these spaces. So that's also one reason why everybody in Venice thinks artists have a lot of money, because normally galleries or artists come and pay huge amounts of rent just to be part of the game during the biennial, to rent a space, to show their art, to be kind of the collaterali. There's these collaterali events, which are in the catalogue, which the biennial kind of curates, but actually they take what they can get You pay 25,000 euros to have the brand of the lion, of the ballena, and to be in the catalog, and that's it. And you have to look for your own space. Nothing is provided. So spaces also from city-owned stuff go up to 25,000, 30,000 euros a month during the... It's like the hotel price. If you want to do something in December, it's only 10,000. So that's kind of insane. Well, we can say that doesn't take away space from people or apartments from people, but I have been during the biennial, I have been in apartments from people. People hire Airbnb and make their proper show. It's kind of bizarre, but it's endless. So the game, that even one would say the art is positive, and of course it's a nice way to visit the city, and I would not exclude myself. I also do that, and I did that. But the art is one. The architecture is a bit less visited, so it's a bit less ranked. But then there's the music biennial, there is the theater biennial, there's the film festival. So in Venice, actually, it never stops. You only have December and January where it's really low season. And also, I knew a lot of people, when the art biennial opening is, they leave the city because they can't stand it. And it's a public which is not really, the Venetians are not really interested in that. It's like a bubble. It's like a satellite. But everybody earns on it in the same time. And that maybe that leads also to the other very, very interesting research project Ingo and Nicolas are leading, is it is linked to digitalization. It is linked to everybody having a GPS on the phone. And I found out that in an interview that people said, listen, it was still supportable before the iPhone had the GPS, because then people run in there, you have this San Marco, Rialto, you go and you run, you have the quick pathway. And as a Venetian, you know how to avoid the masses. You just go around and you have your tracks and you do that. And all this romanticism about getting lost in Venice. You have to get lost in Venice. It's the writers of the 19th century. Only if you get lost, you will really get to know Venice. And Henry James wrote about that and so on. That was absolutely over when people had their running around with their iPhone and not trying to get lost, but trying to find the last angle. So we made a selection of spaces to find out if this is really true.
So we started this little co-project, and Stephanie gave us 13 locations, some of them touristic and some of them less touristic. And then we started a bit playing around with Google Maps. I will show some very preliminary results in a few minutes. But first, Nicolas will a bit introduce into Google Maps as a locative media.
First of all, there's another player in town, right? Which is Google Maps, right? And Google Maps, I guess, shapes the way we, you know, we see the city, but also how we move through the city. You might ask yourself, okay, why does it make sense to study Google Maps, right? And I guess the point we want to push is Google Maps is much more than a platform. It's actually a spatial information infrastructure, really fundamentally shapes, I guess, the experience of urban space. And just a few sort of comments on how, I guess, Google Maps emerged. I mean, I guess you're familiar with the service. It was launched in 2005. There was one sort of key player, one particular individual that really changed the game. That's Paul Rademacher. I'm not sure you've heard of him. He's probably the most famous, most relevant urban cartographer of the 21st century, but you've never heard of him probably. And that's why what he basically did was he was responsible for the first map mashup. So he was the first one who actually hacked Google Maps. So back then, back in 2005, he was looking for a flat. He was on Craigslist. And so he had a list with all the housing offers, but he didn't really have a way to sort of visualize that, right? So what he did was combining these two different sources of data, hacking Google Maps, coming up with the first map mashup. And essentially, he was hired. Google Maps released the API and opened up to many other sort of users, and then fundamentally and sort of step by step sort of, you know, became this huge player by adding, you know, a range of features, air quality, 3D, Google Street View, you name it. So nowadays we have Google Maps as this, I guess, you know, what we would call spatial information infrastructure, and it's more than a platform. It's used globally by 2 billion monthly users. It's sort of free of use. You know, everyone can use this. All you need is a mobile phone, a web browser. It powers other sort of, you know, applications. Think of Uber. And I guess one fundamental or like one important feature when it comes to the quality of infrastructures is the fact that it's mostly invisible, but a breakdown would, you know, lead to, you know, severe consequences, right? So I guess to sum it up, Google Maps as an empirical object is incredibly interesting and, you know, fundamentally shapes the way we see the city, but also how we experience the city.
As I told Stefan, you gave us 13 locations, and the 13 locations can be seen in the next picture. These are the red highlighted locations, and you see they are somehow spread out, and some seem to be more at the fringes of the city, some more in the center. And then we looked at the Google Maps, their reviews and commentaries, and did some very superficial statistics as a first step. And the first comes in the next picture. These are the locations with the most reviews and with the fewest reviews. The red are with the most, but it's the Chiesa San Maggiore, Arsenale, Basilica San Marco, and Madonna dell'Orto in the north. And they have, so what would you guess, which one of them has the most reviews? No, Arsenal is, glaube ich, the second most, yes? Yes. The Basilica di San Marco has by far the most. And the least, some have less than 100, all of these that are orange have less than 100, some only a very few, some less than 10 reviews at all. And the next slide shows where the first reviews from 2010 to 2012 occurred and where the latest comments were posted. And here again you see Arsenale, Basilica di San Marco, and Campo San Giacomo di Rialto, and this Giorgio Maggiore church. And the commentaries start there at 2010, 11 or 12. But there are also some of the more remote locations where the first reviews put in Google Maps 2016 or even 2017, which is interesting as well. And this last slide I found interesting because here we counted the percentage of Italian language commentaries in contrast. We have some where the percentage is between 60 and 80% Italian commentaries, and these are the black ones: Chiesa San Girolamo, Piazza Labia, Piazza Zenobio, and Chiesa San Nicolae dei Mendicoli. Yeah. So these have been reviewed mostly by Italian tourists, while it's not too unexpected, San Marco and these other more prominent sites, there it's between 15 and 30% of all commentaries which are Italian. So that maybe gives a bit an impression who visits these different locations, when and how often.
Can you tell us why you choose these 13?
This is a scientific question. How do you make the choice of your... Yeah, actually, Nicolas and I, we have been in the studio. Among all these pictures, we're still lying on my tables, and I pulled out a map. And actually, we took them
not by accident, but of course the most touristical thing we very much suspected. We also took Rialto, but then Rialto was too expensive for the data scraping. Because so I took that also, of course, because we had some research also on Instagram, and there's a lot of websites or posts on the internet where people kind of offer the most Instagrammable posts, places in Venice. So, of course, these touristical places are also integrated in this kind of Instagram grid. And the less known places, I choose by my preference because I like them. I don't want to pretend that I'm more introduced than all the other tourists. I'm also a tourist. And the last one was actually out of a novel, which I really very much liked. And it was about an idea of a kissing map. It's a love novel, and he said that finally they ended up at that place, and it's actually a dead place. You can't go out. It's only water. And this is a novel from the 70s. So it's quite of interesting that this place is still very, very few or very rarely frequented. And the Chiesa della Sante del Menticoli, for example, is a precious little church. It's really wonderful. But of course, by all these churches you have in Venice, why should you go there? You know, and you only have one day. This is another thing of the touristical itineraries also said in this Instagram advisors. If you have 2 days, so make Venice in 2 days, make Venice in 3 days, make Venice in 1 day. And so that's already clear that you can't go everywhere. And the islands are much less visited.
Does these findings meet your expectations?
Yes, yes. The scientist in me is happy because my thesis is proven. But that's a fantastic collaboration because it's a finding and you prove it. And we had this idea to make this data scraping. And you will see next week, my students will be here, and we had a whole semester about speculative mappings. And I always imagine things like information and data like that, they are rendering them physically. You know, you could just pile up all this, what you made as a data scraping, these comments, they could kind of grow out and you would have a skyline of Google places. You know, I have almost a physical imagination if I see this.
I was a bit surprised that the most reviewed and those who are less reviewed by Italian-speaking commentaries and those that are first in the reviews, that they are somehow spread over the whole place. It's not that it's kind of this center where the most tourists always are, like Markusplatz and so on. But you see that it's, for instance, Madonna dell'Orto comes often in this most visible places, or San Giorgio Maggiore.
Yeah, because it's Tintoretto's church. This is the church where Tintoretto is buried, and Tintoretto lived very close, and he painted it, his scuola painted it all his life. That's how he earned his graveyard. You know, this is also, that's maybe why it is so visited, but also not by everybody. And the other thing about the Italian quotes, it's also interesting, because what does that tell us? Because these are probably not Venetians taking the effort to rate or to write comments in Google Maps about their own city. So that brings me to a phenomenon. And what we don't have to forget is something I never really considered before. The amount of Italian tourists is horribly big. It's not because they're Italian that they're not tourists. And especially the day tourists. So a lot of people from Mestre and also far beyond, they come over the big weekends for the big Christian ferry days. They come to Venice with the family and they come for 1 day too. They are part of the problem too. And a lot of Italians also tell us the most horrible things is the bachelor parties of the Italians. Because they come, it's like if they come from Lichtenberg or Marzahn and to make a party on Alex. And this is even now, this is a real problem. And they don't pay entry because they're from Veneto. So the whole entry thing also would not prevent these people to come.
What I found interesting is this is a real contrast. It's 60 to 80%, and most of them are 70 to 80%, versus 20% or at most 30% Italian commentaries. So that's a real, real difference. So these places really distinguish between in which language the commentaries are
written. But maybe these people, these Italians, have more chance to come more often and to visit more places. And so they have already made the bigger touristic... We don't really know. That's speculation now. That's what I like about speculative mappings, for example. We don't know exactly.
Like seeing this map, that's actually quite interesting because when I mapped out the densities of Airbnb listings or the counts of Airbnb listings, quite coincides with like the areas where you find the most non-Italian reviews. Like the highest densities are between Rialto and San Marco, and also at Arsenal. So like the most touristic areas, of course, the ones where we find the by far highest areas of Airbnbs. But where you see like the most Italian comments and where you see like very, very little reviews, there basically aren't any. That's very, very, very equal, actually.
Super, so that also corresponds, yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
I would be interested in what you said at the beginning, like this, that's the use of Google Maps, if it's like influencing the touristic circulation and the way also, obviously, then the tourists are, like, through their visit or through their renting are basically occupying the city. What do you think about this? I'm not sure we have the data to... you know, correlate this, but just to think about.
I mean, I think there's definitely sort of a correlation, right? Like, I think, I mean, one of the basic questions when it comes to Google Maps is asking yourself, okay, what kinds of spatial logics are actually at play, right? So what kinds of, if you like, zones, what kinds of spaces are actually highlighted and, you know, represented and so on, right? And one basic assumption would be, okay, these are mostly commercial economic spaces. So I'm pretty sure there is a sort of correlation between the number of Airbnbs and but also the way that the city is portrayed via Google Maps.
By looking through all these different reviews, I know you did the, but have you had a look about the pictures and the way Venice is also... I mean, or you only looked at the text or... Because, I mean, that's also one of your favorite topics, right? I mean, the kind of mimetic dimension of Venice. I mean, through, obviously, the whole digitalization and then also through the world with all this copy of Venice. But I was just interested in the way it is here.
Yes, that would be interesting. But we didn't do this yet. But you could analyze the comments, obviously. Look what are the topics, what are, for instance, Google Maps itself presents often mentioned topics in kind of a summary that everybody sees if you are looking up a particular place. But you could do this much more fine-grained with text analysis and data mining of these commentaries. Yeah, and then you could get kind of maybe themes of topics and how they change or continue through the time. And maybe this could provide insight into these questions you are asking. But we didn't do that yet. We could do it, but only with much more time.
I guess one interesting observation that sort of goes in that direction was made by one of our student researchers, and he was sort of pointing out that when you sort of look at these comments, there's a difference, if you like, say, between describing a place, that's a church, and sort of instructing people to act, right? So that's a church, but you should also check out this amazing restaurant which is close by, right? So I guess that's an interesting observation, the way that Google Maps is used. Is it describing or is it instructing?
But I think on the descriptive way, or of course, we would love to see the pictures, the people who left the comments, we would love to see the pictures they did. But then, of course, that's a very, I don't know if you can really get that information. We try to have that in very face-to-face interviews. I really went very often with students, and students are more lucky than I, because if they ask somebody in the street, normally they get answers. If I ask somebody in the street, they get suspicious. So we realized that. So the students are great to gather information, and they talked, for example, with an influencer couple, a couple who photographed and kind of posed. And then they found out that they were in contact. They could see later the posts these people posted. So they knew where these posts were originate from. And they also knew the examples they were trying to be there. So the mimesis, because they already copied. They had a range of other influencers and the photographs they took in Venice. So they wanted to take the same photographs in the same location, but just change the main actors. They even dressed the same or very similar way. So we had that, so we could really verify what was the aim and what was the result.
So maybe as an answer, Derek, actually you can get the pictures from Google Maps, and but everyone can look up for him or herself. And what you are seeing is something that is a bit similar to what you mentioned last, namely the same picture over and over again by different people. And this is something one could analyze as well, maybe to compare kind of a very touristic place where maybe the pictures are much more homogeneous because the expectation what to see and how to take this picture maybe is more formatted in contrast to those less touristic places. But I don't know that yet.
But actually, that brings me to the point that we'll put the picture up again after the presentation. We took down one picture, which corresponds with these two marks, St. Mark's squares. And actually, this is one on the right side, you have Las Vegas. On the left side, you have, let's call it real Venice. So Venice in Italy. And here we had Venice in Shenzhen in China. And that's part of the thing, that people don't only repeat the same photo of the same location over and over, but it is kind of rebuilt all over the world in exactly the same monuments, the same dimensions, the same proportions. The Campanile in Las Vegas has 50 centimeters less height than the Campanile in Venice. So it's not only the picture is the proof that I have been there or I have collected it, so there's an enormous need, and of course Venice is an extreme place, but we have that all over the world.
Simon, you wanted to add something?
Yeah, but that goes back like to your original question, because we have numbers like where tourists overrun Venice. Like we can see this if you would scroll up again. Yeah. I hope the resolution is fine enough, fine grade enough. And as you can see, like the scale goes from 0 to 150-ish listings. You can see that all, like in the areas close to the harbor, like there are no listings basically. I mean, like one or two maybe. But in the tourist center and like all the areas we saw with your reviews, we have like 100 listings per. I don't know, like the edges are 300 meters, so that's an area of maybe 200 square meters, like one of these points. So like between Rialto and San Marco, we have 150 listings per 200 square meters. That's just crazy. Obviously, like there can't be anyone left who lives there.
But I have a really interesting quote of one of my interviewees, of an artist. She has her studio. She lives and works at Rialto. And Rialto is, of course, the bridge. You all know the bridge, but Rialto used to be the market center, used to be the Börse, yeah, of Venice. So it used to be, it's the source of capitalism in Venice. So she said very often her Italian friends and her friends said, are you crazy? How can you work there? It's so noisy. It's horrible when you go out. You have all these people. How can you work there as an artist? And she said, yes, listen, I don't have a choice. I'm here with my studio and I'm happy to have a studio in an apartment. And on the other hand side, I consider it as an industrial zone, because it's the main income source of Venice, as it always was. It's a changed use, of course. And he said most of the artists in all over the world are working in industrial zones, because that's where they can afford studios. So I thought that's a really great comparison, because that's the industrial zone.
This also connects back to this this idea of imaginary, because if you go to Airbnb, they always put like pictures of the surroundings, just because you were talking about like they all make the same picture. So if people go to Airbnb, they see like this picture, like there's the Rialto Bridge, there's like San Marco, and they form, even before they are there, they form this image of, I have to be there in Venice. And then they go there, and obviously they go to Google Maps and see like, okay, from my apartment, it's a 5-minute walk. So for the people back home, I'm going to take this picture. And then they reproduce the cycle, because it's all one big industry which plays together.
That's the main issue of this exhibition. That's why it's called Venice Be Real, is that the images we carry the images we take, the images I take. And when I was at the end looking at all this material, I realized, of course, I'm part of the whole thing. Yeah, and I realized that I was taking pictures all over these years. I was traveling to Venice, and then I focused only on my pictures. It was really an interesting work also, because you go through, and I never photographed things to see if they change or not. That was never my intention. I was just like all of you, like, so, oh, wow, this is beautiful, or oh, my, maybe this is a bit true Venice, or maybe this is an angle of view nobody knows. So, of course, I was also interested to have a backstage vision, a gaze, but actually this is what happens. And when we have the sound piece of the video, it's also interesting because this is quotes from the interviews spoken by an AI. And in the end, there's also somebody tell me, actually, when there was Corona, during the pandemic, we took the most, we, the Venetians, we started to take pictures. We normally don't take pictures anymore. We started to take pictures, and they said that were probably the most incredible pictures all the Venetians have ever taken of the city. And then she says, and that's really beautiful, she says, and we took Venice back. Taking pictures, we took Venice back. That's also interesting because we have this thing, like taking a picture is taking something away from the object you portrait. And here it is so simple because the drone goes close and the pictures are flying away and there is nothing underneath. The city consists in pictures or in photographies. And therefore also here you see all kind of Venices. And I consider that Venice has been, it's not replicated, it's nachgebaut, Nachbilder. It's better in German, yeah, because you have Vorbilder, Bilder, Nachbilder. So it has been, even the built Venices are also picture-based. So I consider that I mix all the Venices here in the exhibition, and you have to look whether you find your Venice.
My mind keeps wandering back to another interviewee of mine, Ava, also an artist from Kreuzberg. And in the quote, I also brought it. She talks about, like, a little bit with a bad conscience about this elitist feel Airbnb has, because she's like, okay, you see all these nice pictures of the world and you get the feeling, okay, so many nice places. Yeah, but of course it only depicts the privileged people, she's like. And as you told me, when you rent, or as you elaborated, when you rent some atelier in Kreuzberg, you maybe put in pictures of the nice surroundings, but you do not put in pictures from the subway station where maybe homeless people are sleeping in the night. So I really wondered also regarding what you were talking about with Venice, what is like the relation between all these pictures and imaginaries and reality? They are really entangled, but somehow also like disconnected, because all these digital representations, I guess also on Google Maps, it's just part
selective.
Yeah, it's selective.
Maybe you want to add something?
A very straightforward question would be to ask, are there sort of forms of resistance when it comes to Airbnb, but also to Google, you know, to Google Maps? And if so, what are these forms?
When it comes to Venice, there's a lot of activists or activism. Really, it is. And I have one student from China who made a huge mapping about activism in Venice because he was so fascinated, because activism, it was great because he did not judge, because a lot of this activism is, we would consider hilarious or not good or effective or whatsoever. And he said, it's great, you didn't judge. He said, no, I can't judge because I come from a country where we don't even have activism. So I'm so fascinated that there is activism. And he might make typologies. So there's a lot of artistic activism, but that produces, of course, attention also towards workless actors whatsoever or people. But I wouldn't say that it's useless. But compared to the politics, and the tourists are not interested in at all. And the government is not interested in all at all, because the elections, as you might know, so when we say there's maybe 30 or 40,000 Venetians left who vote, the whole city of Venice with Marghera and Mestre is 250,000 voters. And of course, so the mayor of Venice is a very rich person who profits also very well from a lot of politics about Venice. So there was a lot of efforts in the last 10 years to get separated again. So the Venetians wanted to be independent again from the mainland, because they thought they make politics and we pay off this politics. They exploit us as a touristical theme park, and meanwhile the Vaporetti pay for the buses in Mestre. That's a huge
resistance, if you want, or huge discussion, where, as you have also to know, it's about urbanism and history of urbanism and this decision to make Greater Venice, as we had a decision 100 years ago to make Greater Berlin. It's not so long that we unified our villages to one big city, yeah? That was an idea under the fascist government of the Duce, and it was his the urban planner was also his financial minister later, so it was Vulpi, the guy was called Vulpi, and he decided to make the modern Venice, because after the colonialization through the Austrians, it was occupied not only by Napoleon, but then also by the Austrians. The Austrians put a lot of modernity in the train, etc., and they also created streets in Venice, which have been canals before, and so on. So, and then the Italians wanted to take over themselves the development of industrialization and modernity. So that was a decision from the 20s. It's very difficult to tear apart such an... And I think also it's difficult. They live from each other, but it should be... The decision should be taken more consensually.
Maybe keeping with this topic of resistance, and obviously we are interested in space. Do you know like where these cells of resistance are located? Because, for example, in Cape Town, we see that the social initiatives are not located in the hotspot where the issue is the greatest, so not in the CBD, mm-hmm. but more on the outskirts of it. So on the Atlantic seafront, you're probably better... Should better talk about this. But on the Atlantic seafront, like in Greenpoint and Seapoint, like westwards.
Where the issue is creeping up, basically. Yeah, where it's building up and they see this development. Okay, now it's coming to our neighborhood as well. This is where they are located.
Yeah, exactly. And I was just wondering, like, if you know if people from within the city center are concerned with these issues, or if it's more of a people who actually live on the mainland and maybe go back to the city and feel like they've lost something there, or people in Lido who feel like, okay, now this madness from the main city is coming to our little community, stuff like that, you know?
That's actually interesting. That comes up in the interviews because it's very, very provincial. It's even so, it's Sestieri. It's not city quarters. It's 6 Sestieri, and Lido is not even part of it. And the Lido people have a very own identity. I met a lot of people born, raised up, and still living in Lido with all the family around. And that you have it also, the identification is very, very local. It's really, there's people from St. Helena, they stay in St. Helena. And so these manifestations, I think they are all over, and they're very often led by stranieri, by not Italians. Like, for example, this very famous activist who threw herself in front of the big ships. And she's a British woman married to an Italian noble. And so these things, which are maybe mediatically interesting, they happen where it happens. So the big, the big tourist ships, they're not allowed to cross Venice anymore. They stop outside now and the people get driven in with the smaller boats. But it did not reduce these travels, it just prevents them to come in. Yeah. So you can't really say that they're... It doesn't really come to the outer skirts. I think it can't really be more. So Lido is also always was touristical because it's a beach.
Did I understand you right that like the foreigners who came to Venice are the ones who are protesting?
Yes.
So yeah. Basically they're trying to defend like their imagination of Venice and the locals.
Well, you could also take it more positive because they have this clear look. They come from outside. They see what is going wrong, and maybe they don't have so much private interests yet because they're not living there 5 centuries with their palazzo back to them. But also, they get very much criticized from the Italians. But it's really a phenomenon. Mostly, it's German, British, French women, mostly women also, and rich women affording.
Super interesting.
Could afford to protest, yeah, or to...
So I just have now to thank everyone. Thank you so much for also like playing with all this new data and having this this exchange. Thank you for being so attentive and enjoy the exhibition and the drinks.
Genau. Thank you.